None better.
Oh, that is not as good as your lame tongue would have us believe. Put out your hand there, Paddy John. Let's split the difference with you.
Ah, be good, yes. Ah, no. Oh, fine, healthy evening, Mr. Farrelly. Glory be to God.
Well, bookkeep, you have your share of it, haven't you?
Good evening, sir. Long years, sir.
Give it for you with that, Joe McGinty. Don't forget your account due on Wednesday morning.
There a couple, Mr. Farrelly, sir.
Out, sir. Hello to me, way.
Well, I can't tell you the name of the play from which that extract is taken. We believe it was written by Paul Vincent Carroll, but what I can tell you is that it was recorded in February 1949, about a month and a half, in fact, before I was born, and that it's the earliest piece of recorded radio drama in the RTE archives. 2 years earlier, on Monday, August the 18th, 1947, a group of actors arrived at the Radio Éireann studios in Henry Street, Dublin, and were assigned to their duties. They were to be known as the Radio Éireann Repertory Company, now known as the RTE Players, but always affectionately called the Rep. Because of the way Radio Éireann was run, their status was deemed to be temporary, unestablished civil servants. Now, most civil servants had to sit for an exam or attend an interview, but these temporary, unestablished civil servants had to audition.
It is a curious fact that novelists have a way of making us believe that luncheon parties are invariably memorable for something very witty that was said, or for something very wise that was done. But they seldom spare a word for what was eaten.
It is part of the novelist's convention not to mention soup and salmon and ducklings, as if soup and salmon and ducklings were of no importance whatsoever, as if nobody ever smoked a cigar or drank a glass of wine.
Here, however, I shall take the liberty to defy that convention and to tell you that the lunch on this occasion began with soles, sunk in a deep dish over which the college cook had spread a counterpane of the whitest cream, save that it was branded here and there with brown spots, like the spots on the flank of a dome.
Let us, sir, embrace some system or other before we end this session. Do you mean to tax the medical and to draw productive revenue from this? If you do, speak out. Name, fix, ascertain this revenue. Settle its quantity, the finest objects. Provide for its collection. And then fight when you've something to fight for.
If you murder, rob. If you kill, take possession. And do not appear in the character of madmen as well as assassins, violent, vindictive, bloody, and tyrannical, without an object. But may better counsels guide you.
The voices of Mary Keane, Aileen Hart, Deirdre O'Mara, Leo Layden, Lionel Day, whose real name was Lalo D and was actually a brother of the famous Jimmy, and Joe Lynch. Voices and names that conjure up memories of a bygone age. And indeed, that's what this evening's all about. Conjuring up memories of 50 years of radio drama performed by the Rep. And to help us along on this trip down memory lane, I'm joined by Peg Monaghan, Aidan Grinnell, Colette Proctor, and from Radio na Gaeltacht, the studios in Ballinagall, Micheál O'Hay. Incidentally, when I was talking to Joe Lynch recently, and by the way, he sends his regards and regrets that he's not able to join us this evening, he described the Rep as the nicest bunch of people that you could ever meet. And he'll get no arguments from me about that. You're all very, very welcome. Micheál, I'll start with you. Whose brainchild was the Rep?
Well, there is little doubt about it that the man who fought hardest for the foundation of the Rep was Robardo Farrakhan, the former controller of programs. He was the only begetter, and he had an awful fight, as you say in your title, to get these unestablished civil servants in as members of a permanent repertory company.
And you were the first producer, Micheál, assigned to them.
That's right. And with Robardo Farrakhan and Ria Mooney, who was then producer at the Abbey, we auditioned, I think, 400 people for 18 vacancies in the very fine summer of 1947. And just, as you say, we're going on a kind of a memory lane about the Rep. Listening to your first recording there,
yeah,
and saying it was by Paul Vincent Carroll.
That's what we think, anyway.
I recall now that it is a piece that isn't very well known. It's a play called Interlude by Paul Vincent Carroll, And it's one of his shorter pieces. He wrote a lot of short plays, some of which were produced by Radio Éireann at the time, plays like Cuggers and Interlude. But that was definitely Interlude. And one of the voices, of course, was Joe Lynch, whom you quoted already.
I thought I recognised that. And, Micheál, if anybody could identify that, it had to be you. Listen, thanks for that. Peg, you were there on the very, very first day yourself.
Yes. Oh, I was very excited at the prospect of a company being formed to specialise in radio drama. Because I can remember as far back as when I was 11 years of age, listening to a play on radio for the first time. It was a play that Maureen Hewley, the Abbey actress, was putting on, and she wanted young boy actors for it, and she chose my brother as one of the boys. He was a pupil of hers at the time. And so we were all at home listening to this. Now, at home we were always engaged in theatricals. That was our way of entertaining each other. And I couldn't for the life of me understand how a play could come out on the radio. It puzzled me. It also fascinated me. But then it was years later, you know, when you go to your, as in my case, the Abbey School of Acting, then the stage and so on. And then suddenly this opportunity presents itself. And so I was very, very excited about it. Now I'm going to learn how it's all done.
Aidan, when did you actually join?
I think it was 1961.
So you're really a new kid on the block.
Oh, absolutely, and yeah. I felt like a new kid on the block coming in. Not that that means I was uncomfortable with the company. I was received with open arms, and I like to quote what you said at the very beginning of this program, that my happiest years, really, outside my own company, where I was also in a team, which was Longford Productions, mm-hmm. my happiest years after Longford Productions had failed with Edward Longford's death, were with the Rep. People were really like an extended family. It wasn't a question of going to work. You came into your family every morning. And there was absolutely no feeling of rivalry or one-upmanship or bitchiness of any kind at all.
We were all learning, Aidan, weren't we?
Yes.
It was a new art form for all of us.
That is true, but not for the older members. I was the one primarily who was learning. I was new to the microphone, although I'd been broadcasting. I had broadcasted
freelance.
Oh, long years previously.
But as a team.
It was a wonderful thing, and there was a feeling of great security.
The Rep, if you like, was a unique institution, as far as I know, because in no other English-speaking country, at least, was there an attempt to recruit a permanent company of actors at that particular time. The BBC had a small number, about a half a dozen people on short-term contracts. Yeah. But, of course, London was London, and they had an enormous choice of people available. But in Dublin, because a great number of the stage, and Aidan will remember back that, and Peg will remember, that a great number of stage people, not a great number, a considerable number,
yes.
were after five rehearsals.
Yes.
And the two things coincided.
That's
rehearsals
right.
at the Abbey after five to suit the civil servants and teachers who were cast in plays, and rehearsals after five for the radio drama. Of course, the radio drama took second place.
I was talking there about Aidan being a new kid on the block. Colette Proctor, you're a mere blow-in into the Rep, aren't you? How long have you been around?
Junior infants at this stage.
How long have you been around?
I've only been in the Rep about, I'm trying to think now, probably 22 or 23 years.
A mere blink in the eye of the Almighty.
But I do remember when you're talking about this, and it is a great family to belong to, Daphne Carroll saying to me when I came in first that she had been here 18 years. And I'm thinking to myself, how could anybody be here for 18 years?
My earliest contacts with radio drama were in my granny's kitchen on the North Strand Road, where the play was greeted, I suppose, with an almost religious reverence. And one of the voices that engraved itself on my memory belonged to Jeanette Waddell. Here she is in a scene from The Dreaming Dust by Dennis Johnston with John Stevenson.
What do you wish me to do?
Tell her that... No. No, you mustn't do that. Tell her... Oh, I cannot think.
Am I to tell her that I am your wife?
No, no, you must never do that, never.
Oh, but why, Bresso, what harm can come of it now?
Disaster can come of it. The most unspeakable charges to overwhelm us both of us, do you understand?
And surely that fear must have left you long ago, Bresso. It is now almost 60 years since these things happened.
That fear will never leave me. It is the torture of all my waking hours. It is right that our friends should suspect our marriage, but for us to confirm it in any way or to be found alone together, oh, no, 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 never.
Very well, Presto. I shall tell her then that we are not married.
That was Jeanette Waddell as Stella and John Stevenson as Dean Swift in the 1966 production by the author, Dennis Johnston, of his play The Dreaming Dust. Peg, you were in that yourself as well, weren't you?
Yes, I had a small part as Mrs. Dingley. She was a kinswoman of Stella's. And so I had plenty of opportunity to listen to the larger performances. There was always a great discussion in these historical plays, but particularly in this one because of the relationship between Stella and Vanessa with Swift, and were they married or were they not married. And then I remember later on in the play, Swift rides down to Selbridge to confront Vanessa, and there's a wonderful hysterical scene from Una Collins between Swift and Vanessa in that. But as I say, there was always this discussion in historical plays, and we took a particular interest in them.
So you were all semi-intellectuals in the
classics. Oh, very much so. Brought our own tuppa halfpenny worth to it.
Jeanette and John, they were very, very much in the grand manner, weren't they?
Yes. I think Jeanette was absolutely, totally acceptable as non-Irish characters. I mean, ascendancy types, things like that and everything else. And I remember meeting her for the very first time in my life, when I was appearing in, for the first performance of my life, in a play by Sacha Guitry, a little one-act play in Trinity Players. And I was quaking in a chair, waiting to be made up. And Jeanette was the one who came along and made me up and calmed my nerves and soothed me and let me go on and do this little thing.
Colette, she had a great fondness for horse racing, hasn't she?
She had a great love of horses. But I just wanted to say what Peg and Aidan were saying, and Jeanette made me think of it too. For us younger people in the rep then, it was a great education and it was a great way of learning drama and poetry and, you know, all the stuff one gets to do on radio.
Yes,
and the older members of the rep were always extremely kind in sharing their knowledge of things with us, and one got to do things you would never get to do otherwise. It was a great education in that sense. But Jeanette and her horses, Jeanette loved the racing and the horses, and she was forever coming in with these big stacks of photographs to show us of a studying form and showing us photographs of jumps that horses had either got over or were just about to go over, or races she'd been at, or the Punchestown. She used to like to go to the, you know, the weekend, the trials and things like that. She loved all that sort of thing. But she was a very kind lady. When she was leaving a place she had in her later years, she invited me along to her apartment and asked me to take something I would like. So I have this nice little table in the corner of my front room with my lamp on it that Jeanette gave me, which I am very fond of.
Lovely memory. Micheál, did you work with Jeanette very much?
Oh, very much. And, of course, she came of a great theatrical family. Her father was Rutherford Maine, the Abbey dramatist, who wrote many plays for the Ulster Players in the north. And her aunt, of course, was Helen Waddell, the great translator of Chinese lyrics and of medieval poetry. And she was a wonderful person.
Well, it's time now for another piece of drama. This is P.J. O'Connor's adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula, which incidentally was first published 150 years ago. And this is how it was introduced to the listener.
We now present Dracula by Bram Stoker, freely adapted for radio by P.J. O'Connor. We advise listeners who are nervous, or who may be alone or with children, that parts of this program are quite startling.
Welcome to my house. Enter freely and of your own free will. Come freely, go safely, and leave something of the happiness you bring.
Count Dracula?
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome, Mr. Harker, to my house. Come in. The night air is chill, and you must need to eat and rest.
Bram Stoker's Dracula, with Peter Dix as Jonathan Harker and Thomas Studley as the Count. Now, there's a prevailing myth that the continuity announcer Bridget Kilfeather did the Fay Wray impersonation, in other words, the scream. But I have it from the horse's mouth that that is only a myth. But it does give an idea of the talent of Tom Studley and, as you said, Michal, probably the greatest radio actor ever.
Studley, it's a case apart as far as radio acting goes.
Yeah, Michal, somebody, one of the sound operators here, he gave me a description of Studley, which I think is pretty good and it's pretty true, that he not only got the character right, but then he brought out all the faults and foibles in the character.
That's true. His powers of concentration, I think, were better. He didn't come from the stage. He came, in fact, from the civil service. He came from being an established, I think, civil servant to being a non-established one. Because he worked for Gaelic services in Connemara. He also was a very good Irish speaker, and he had a wonderful ear. And I often tell a story. I think it's worth repeating, because it confirms what nearly everybody has said about him. We once had a series called Showman's Caravan. It was based on the life and times of Val Valzen, who was an old-time touring actor, one of those who went around the fit-ups throughout Ireland, and who was a well-known, I think they were called recitationists in those days, on Radio Éireann. But Val, like a great deal of the touring actors, he couldn't have survived on the road without being fairly fond of a drop. And he remained fond of a drop when he came to me to do this six-part serial on his life story. And he came along one evening. Everything was live. There was no recording. You were always anxious to know would some of the cast, not all of the cast, be across in time from Jerry the Wires or some of the pubs are around Humphreys and Moore Street.
Indeed.
Or the Tower Bar.
So but what happened on that night?
Val was an old practitioner, and I very stupidly didn't check fully before the play began. Maybe I was a little late myself, fiddling with effects. And when Valzen got his cue to come on to tell his life story, I heard nothing coming over the mic, only an indistinct kind of a mumble. He was so far over the top that he had to be moved away by the other actors, and Tom Studley came forward. And not only did he give an impersonation of Val Valzen, he took the script from Valzen's hand. He gave an impersonation of Val Valzen a little under the weather. So the thing knitted together faultless.
Continuity.
I wasn't at all pleased. Yeah. And I feel, even to this day for the record, that I never adequately thanked Tom Studley for taking RTE and Radio Éireann out of a very, very difficult spot, and particularly myself, who was so remiss that I didn't check on the irrepressible Val Valzen.
Well, I'm sure Tom accepts your thanks now. Hopefully he's listening to us tonight. Drama from RTE always does well in international festivals, and Radio Éireann, as it was known then, won the coveted Prix Italia for the first time in 1961 with your own Michal, your own adaptation of Seamus Kelly's story, The Weaver's Grave.
The Weaver was a dream.
Maybe Mrs. Heffer wouldn't give in to that.
Whether she gives in to it or whether she doesn't give in to it, it's a dream, Master Maher was. And his loom and his shuttles and his warp and bars and his bobbins and the threads he put upon the shift and wrecks were all a dream. And the only thing he ever wove upon his loom was a dream. And what's more, every woman that ever come into his head and every wife he married was a dream. I'm telling you that, Nan, and I'm telling it to you of the weaver. His wife was a dream, and his death is a dream. And his widow there is a dream, and all the world is a dream. Do you hear me, Nan? This world is all a dream.
I hear you very well, Father.
And I'm a dream.
This is the most terrible old man yet.
I'm a dream. The idiot laughing in the street, the king looking at his crown, the woman turning her head to the sound of a man's step, the bells ringing in the belfry, the man walking his land, the weaver as his loom, the cooper as his battle, the pope stooping for his red slippers. They're all a dream.
Well, there was the legendary Arthur O'Sullivan in the weaver's grave with Moore O'Sullivan, and of course you were in there yourself, Peg, weren't you?
That was the first time we won the Prix d'Italia. And we were taken to the Shelbourne Hotel, great reception, and presented with gold medals. It was then transferred to television. So I don't know what you feel about it, Micheál. Was the radio presentation superior to the television? How do you think it transferred?
Not only was it on television, and you played yourself in it, Peg, I recall, but it was also done in the Peacock on stage, and Maureen Egona, Louis Silverton was a fine actress, played the part you played, I remember, in the Peacock production.
Well, Peg's question was it better on radio?
Essentially a radio piece.
Yes, the word imagery was absolutely wonderful. I mean, the antics of the two old men, Eamon Kelly and Tom Studley, it was, I mean, you could visualize it as you heard the antics they got up to.
That's right.
But somehow when you saw it, I don't think it was quite as funny.
No. And Archie O'Sullivan, again, came from a different... There's no harm mentioning where they came from, some of those people who were with us. Archie was an out-and-out professional. John Stevenson, I think all his life, was until he came into Radio Éireann, was working as a printer in the stamping department in the castle. But Archie seemed to be spent his life on
tour. He was
tour
in the fit-ups,
with Louis Dalton and all the touring companies before ever he came to the Rep. And he was well-known on the stage. I remember him in The Black Stranger. But winning the Italia Prize gave, not because of my particular association, but it was a great feather in the Rep's cap, and it was produced, I think, in about 20 other countries in different languages.
Well, it was a great adaptation, Micheál, and of course a superb performance from Archie. Over the years, guests of international standing have been more than happy to appear with the Rep. Sybil Thorndike, Lynn Redgrave, Colin Blakely, Harry Andrews, we'll have more about him later, and Spike Milligan, to name but a few. We also should mention Micheál MacLeamore and his partner Hilton Edwards. And it's Hilton we hear next in the role of Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, having conjured up a somewhat familiar-sounding devil.
Now, Faustus, what wouldst thou have me do?
I charge thee, wait upon me whilst I live, to do whatever Faustus shall command, be it to make the moon drop from her sphere, or the ocean to overwhelm the world.
I am a servant to great Lucifer, and may not follow thee without his leave. No more than he commands must we perform.
Did not he charge thee to appear to me?
No, I came now hither of mine own accord.
Did not my conjuring raise thee? Speak.
That was the cause, but yet per accidens.
From Dan Treston's 1964 production of Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus, Hilton Edwards in the title role, and of course yourself, Aidan Grinnell, as Mephistopheles. You worked with Hilton, of course, quite a lot, didn't you?
Yes, I did, quite a lot, and Hilton was a hero of mine. Not to begin with, because I felt he was very intimidating, but that wore off very soon. I realized really what his main interest in life was: getting the show on the road, lighting it, and making sure that nobody disgraced him, particularly in the smaller parts. And he really was a great director. He was a director who would do what is forbidden nowadays to directors. he would leap on the stage and show the actor exactly how he wished him to perform a certain movement or a certain piece of business. And he had a tremendous deftness and skill about little pieces of stage business. He was a brilliant Iago, and on one particular speech to Rodrigo, I think, plotting the downfall of Othello, he peeled an apple in one continuous movement in time with the verse, so that the peel unwound in a hypnotic way while he concentrated on the peeling, and yet the verse was there sowing the evil into Rodrigo's mind. And it was done and timed absolutely to perfection. He had an enormous rings of peel, mm-hmm, all joined together at the end of it. That was typical of Hilton, one piece of business. He filled a pipe in a hypnotic way, too, as the old sea captain in Anna Christie.
And, of course, I mean, the voice was so good and the command of language. Did he do other radio work, Peg?
Yes, I remember he came in to play in the Barretts of Wimpole Street, and it was quite electrifying because he suggested the incestuous relationship between himself and his daughter Elizabeth. And then there was her young cousin who came in, and again, he suggested the sexual overtones there as well. That was beautifully played by Daphne Carroll. I always remember her exit line. She said, "Arrivederci, dearest spa." To Elizabeth.
We shouldn't forget the producer either, Dan Treston. Now, Dan had many achievements in radio. Apart from being a noteworthy producer, he was an actor and a writer, and his play Piano in the River won the 1965 Pre-Italia.
They say pianos cost more to move than to buy. You can get one for a song, but transportation is the problem. Now, take that piano in. Well, no, I don't need to mention the name of the pub on the far quay.
I never saw a piano there.
No, but there is one. Oh. Isn't the whole roof resting on a piano in the empty room above the upstairs lounge? If they move that piano, the whole second place will collapse. That's why you never seen it. But mark my words, one day I know that when Tommy Owens, Joe Comfort and Mick Burden are drinking there with their intellectual friends, crash, bang, and the piano will drop right through the ceiling and the roof on top of it. And that'll be the end of, well, you know where. Do you know that the devil was seen in that pub when it was under a different name?
Yeah, well, perhaps, but that doesn't answer my question. Whose piano was this? Where did it come from?
Seamus Ford and Brendan Colwell, always known to us as Benny, in Dan Treston's 1965 Pre-Italia winner, Piano in the River. They're two legends, aren't they, Seamus Ford and Benny Colwell?
Oh, yes.
You've worked with them quite a lot, haven't you, Colette?
Brendan must be in a lot of prize-winning plays. I was in one he did, which won the Premio Ondas, another year, a play by Joe O'Donnell. But what Seamus and Brendan were part of what I call the Dublin cast, and I loved being in any of the O'Caseys with them. Brendan was a wonderful fluter in the Plough and the Stars, and Seamus Ford, I think, Peg, did he play Uncle Peter another time? But they were wonderful in any of those plays, and it was great to be in them with them, you know, they were.
And the other thing was, I mean, they understood O'Casey so well,
didn't
they?
You know, yes, the sounds and the people in them and everything, it was wonderful.
And the rhythm of the speeches.
And the rhythm of the speeches, yes, and Peg, indeed, was a wonderful Juno.
Of course, all of the actors in the rep had to display a remarkable versatility and play a wide range of parts. Sometimes the lead, sometimes a lord or lady to swell a scene or two, sometimes a small child, and sometimes even animals of every shape and size. I think you yourself, Peg, you've played so many roles, but to me, you will always be the long-suffering Alice Foley.
I don't even expect the occasional box of chocolates or a bunch of flowers.
Flowers?
Well, you needn't seem so surprised. Some men have been known to buy them for their wives. In fact, while I was waiting for you at the window just now, I saw your next-door neighbour, Jack Kelly, bringing some home to his wife.
Huh?
Oh, they weren't anything to write home about, only a bunch of violets. But it was the thought.
As a matter of fact,
as Alice, I was saying, I don't expect those sort of things, but I do expect a little consideration.
Look, I know you'll never believe me, Alice, but
there's the rain. I knew it was going to turn wet.
Oh, that's a pity. I hope it'll have eased off before we start out for the cinema.
I'm not going to any cinema tonight.
Oh.
What sort of a fool do you take me for?
get myself soaking wet, traipsing all that way to see an old film, when I can make myself comfortable at home. Honestly, Tom, you think you hadn't a home at all, the way you're always wanting to leave it? I just can't understand you sometimes.
You can't understand me. That makes two of us, Alice. Sometimes I just can't understand you.
With Flowers, an episode from the most successful, or probably the only really successful, situation comedy on Radio Éireann, The Foley Family by David Hayes. George Green was the irascible Tom Foley, and Peg Monaghan played his poor wife Alice. Incidentally, the music, because I know somebody's going to write in and ask about it, it is Le Jet d'Eau by Sidney Smith. Now, haven't I done my research well? You did, of course. Yes, I know that.
You did it very well, Jeff.
Thank you very much, behold.
The plays you succeed long before there was television on Sunday nights, they were an institution because they came after Joe Linane's Question Time. Mm-hmm. They had an enormous audience, and we had a handover of a very good audience, and the Radio Éireann players were well able to hold that, whether they were doing Shakespeare or doing George Shields.
Peg, what was it like playing Alice Foley?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that, as you mentioned yourself, Jerry, David Hayes, the writer, he had a natural gift for situation comedy.
Yeah.
And he had that wonderful conversational technique that's so required for radio. I mean, you were handed the script, and every character that he introduced into the script, they were so easy to play. And yet, of course, when you come to the character, the main character of Tom Foley, what George Green added to that character was something out of the ordinary. He was quite extraordinary.
There's a great quality of self-righteous indignation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he was entrenched in the character. And when he'd turn round and say to me, "Jeannie McAllister, don't understand," I would go speechless. And, you know, you really had to laugh it out of your system during the rehearsal, because and then be absolutely po-faced when your line came. But he'd look at you in astonishment then when he'd see that you had folded up laughing. But
tell me about Alice herself. I mean, she was really the power behind the throne, wasn't she?
Well, I remember David Hayes described her character as the elastoplast, somebody who just stuck together the pieces, the destruction that Tom managed to create everywhere, in every situation he found himself. I think he said she's like a lot of wives, that she's there listening patiently and tries to patch it together again and keep the family on the road, as it were.
Well, when George Green died, sadly, in 1985, many tributes were paid by his colleagues and friends, including this one.
He was a kindly critic. He was always constructive, with positive advice on what it was to be an actor. When I joined the Radio Éireann Players in 1957, he was still my mentor. To George, preparation was all. His was the art that conceals art, and his command, authority, and presence in performance was the result of painstaking research and preparation. Once he suggested that I read Ulysses, and when I found this unrewarding, he told me to go back and read it aloud. As with all his advice, this worked.
That's the voice of a man who's equally at home on radio, television, the big screen, or the stage. He's currently receiving rave notices for his performance in The Weir by Conor McPherson at London's Royal Court Theatre, and he's taken time out to join us. Jim Norton, how are you, sir?
I'm very well, and I'm very, very thrilled to be able to join. I'm just sorry I can't be there.
And you know, Peg, Aidan, Kales, and Michal, they're all here?
How are you all?
Mates.
Yeah, hi, Peg.
Jim, you started as a child actor with the Rep.
Yeah, I'm afraid I did, yeah. It all started out with a song. I like lots of show business stories. I appeared on a program called Children at the Microphone way back. I think I sang Who Is Sylvia in my piping soprano voice. And then there was a little radio series called Sinbad the Sailor, which I was asked to be in. I think Faye Sargent and Kitty O'Callaghan did that. And during the run of that show, the part of Brendan and the Foley family became available. I guess the actor who played it, his voice had broken, so I was auditioned by Seamus Brannock for the Foley family, and I joined. For many happy years, I played Brendan, with Peg, of course, as my radio mother.
I remember your quiet authority, even at that age.
Well, the authorities there may not be so quiet anymore.
Yeah, I don't think so.
So,
no.
Listen, you joined the rep proper, when was it, 57?
In 1957, I joined the rep, and I was there from 57 until 1963, which were like the happiest years of my life, because I was surrounded by, being a kind of quite a young person, I was surrounded by these truly wonderful actors who were a source of great wisdom, advice, encouragement, you know, constructive criticism. It was a wonderful time, and it really was like jumping in the deep end, because it wasn't a question of can you play the part, you were cast and you had to do it.
Yeah.
So it was a terrific training ground, which I'll never forget, because I learned so much during that time.
Yeah, Colette was saying something similar earlier, but one of the things that strikes me about the rep is, you know the way friendships have lasted.
That's true, yes, yeah. Mm. So, I mean, some amazing people who are just extraordinary. I mean, Eamon Kelly, you know, who I worked with quite recently in the theatre, and, of course, Eamon Keane and Peg, Una Collins, Frank O'Dwyer, Benny Caldwell, and of course, Tom Studley, who was, I mean, the man of many parts, an extraordinary actor. And there was it was just wonderful, because there was so much to learn. And the great thing about the rep is that when I joined, all the actors who were in the company had very successful careers in the theatre prior to that. So they had all that wealth of experience that I was able to kind of draw on.
But you were right, Jim, when you said George was such a kindly critic.
He was.
Because I remember a play I was in called A Child is Born. It was by Stephen Vincent Bennett, an American verse play. And I had a line to say, I am a Baron Bow. And I would say, I am a Baron Bow, you see. And George said, no, he said, you must put the emphasis on the Baron. And he looked at me with those huge brown eyes. He said, remember, you are Baron.
Yes.
You see? And then, of course, we dissolved in laughter and then said, now say it. So I had to go over and over it again and said, I am a Baron Bow.
Jim, when we were talking recently, you were telling me that you had experience of another, well, I suppose you could call him classical Irish writer, Brendan Behan.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Well, I was I was quite young at the time, and it was a play. I think it may well have been one of Behan's first plays, a play called Moving Out.
Oh, yeah.
It was about, you know, families moving out from the inner city out to Ballyfermot, and I played a little Dublin Gurrier in it. And I thought this man was amazing, this wonderful kind of character who'd sit on the floor of the studio and talk to me. I think I was about 12, 13. And he said to me one day, he said, what does your L fella do? I said, I was very proud. I said, my father is the manager of bacon shops in Grafton Street, which then was a kind of posh shop where they sold camembert and things like that, and had a delicatessen. So the next day, Behan appeared at the door of the shop late in the evening. I think he probably had a few. And he roared up the length of this shop. He said, hey, Norton, you'll never be as good a man as your son. Because my father came out and said, who the hell was that? Who was that man who came in with his shirt open down to his navel? I said, oh, he's called Brendan Behan. He's actually a writer. He's a very good writer. So he and Brendan Behan, my dad and Brendan Behan, eventually became great friends. And whenever Brendan had a good payday, he'd go in and get a side of bacon or whatever. And they remained friends until Brendan died.
It was a great story, Jim. You know, I was saying a few minutes ago to Peg how, in spite of all the parts she played, that to me she'll always be Alice Foley. But to me, you're always going to be Tom Sawyer.
So, oh, yeah.
Listen, thanks very much for joining us,
not
Jim.
At all.
And continued success to you.
Yes, and good luck to you all.
Thanks a million, Jim.
Bye.
God bless you.
Bye.
Well, Jim mentioned Brendan Behan, and we turn now to the 1956 production of his powerful play, The Queer Fellow.
Next I was on was a little Protestant lad. He asked to be walked backwards from the condemned cell to the hanghouse so he wouldn't see the rope. Then the young clergyman who was attending asked if the canon would come with him. He had never seen an execution before. I went to the canon that night and I asked him. A fine big man he was those times. Regan, says he, I thought I might have escaped this time, but you never escape. I suppose neither of us ever will. Ah, well. Ah, well, says he, maybe being hung 20 times will get us a minute or two sooner out of purgatory, and that'll be something, Regan. That'll be something.
Amen, here near.
In the morning, The young clergyman was great and read a bit of the Bible with the young Protestant lad while we waited outside. Then he came out with him, holding his hand and telling him in their own way to lean in God's mercy that was stronger than the power of men. And I walked beside him and guided him backwards onto the trap and under the beam. Then the rope was put round him and the washer under his ear and the hood down over him. And the young clergyman still called out to me in a grand, steady voice in through the hood and stroked his head till he went down.
Noel Lynch is the young warder Cremin, who, on the night before a hanging, listens to the advice of his mentor, Warder Regan, played by an actor who's been correctly described as a national treasure, Eamon Kelly.
Eamon Kelly, of course, came from the Listowel Drama Group. I remember himself and his wife, Maura O'Sullivan, coming up. I had seen them at some festival down in Limerick, and they came up. And Eamon Kelly, not from Listowel, but he played with the Listowel Players, and just like Eamon Keane, he was a first-class radio man. But he went on, and still is, I think, one of the great storytellers of this generation.
The voices of the RTE Players, or the Rep, were familiar by now to radio listeners, but no one really knew what they actually looked like. Well, that situation was rectified when the company took to the stage of the Gaiety Theatre for the 1978 Dublin Theatre Festival with a Fado farce, Sauce for the Goose.
But if you refuse to go, I shall call my husband.
Oh, you've got a husband.
Precisely.
All right, then. Let's forget the idiot.
Idiot. My husband.
Husbands of attractive women are always idiots.
Very well, then. We shall see how this idiot deals with you. You refuse to go?
More than ever now.
Very well. Corbin!
Oh, what a hideous name.
Darling!
Corbin!
You call me, darling?
Fuffler, damnation!
Pontagnac! How good to see you! My dear friend! How are you?
Fine, fine.
He knows you.
Well, this is a surprise.
Surprise? You're in my house. You must have expected to see me.
No. I mean, what a surprise for you.
Yes, it certainly is.
Colette Proctor, Aidan Grinnell and Jim Reid wowing the audience at the Gaiety Theatre in 1978 with Fado's Sauce for the Goose. Well, of course, apart from your role in Sauce for the Goose, you've had many triumphs in your career, Colette, not least of which was when you played Desdemona to that great British character actor Harry Andrews in the role of Othello.
Swear thou art Alice.
Heaven doth truly know it.
Heaven truly knows that thou art false as hell.
To whom, my lord? With whom? How am I false?
Ah, 'tis demon. Away, away, away.
Oh, alas, that every day. Why do you weep? Am I the motive of these tears, my lord? If happily you, my father, do suspect an instrument of this your calling back, lay not your blame on me. If you have lost him, I have lost him too.
Had it pleased heaven to try me with affliction, had they rained all kinds of sores and shames on my bare head, steeped me in poverty to the very lips, given to captivity me and my utmost hopes, I should have found in some place of my soul a drop of patience. But alas, to make me a fixed figure for the time of scorn, to point his slow unmoving finger at.
I hope my noble lord esteems me honest.
The summer flies are in the shambles that quicken even with blowing. Oh, the weed! Who art so lovely fair and smell so sweet that the sense aches at thee. Wouldst thou hadst ne'er been born?
Alas, what ignorant sin have I committed?
Was this fair paper, this most goodly book, made to write whore upon? What committed? Committed? Oh, thou public commoner, what committed? Impudent strumpet!
By heaven, you do me wrong!
Are you not a strumpet?
No, as I am a Christian. If to preserve this vessel for my lord from any other foul unlawful touch be not to be his trumpet, I am none.
What, not a whore?
No, as I shall be saved.
It's possible.
Oh, heaven forgive us.
Colette Proctor as Desdemona and Harry Andrews as Othello in Lawrence Foster's 1985 production of Shakespeare's tale of jealousy and revenge. Colette, Harry Andrews, everybody knows the face, but few people will be able to put a name to him.
Yes, I know one always associates him with film, and he's so well known in that sphere, but he is a great Shakespearean actor and was a great Shakespearean actor, and it was wonderful working with him. He was a lovely man and he was very nice to work with, and Lawrence always does a great production on Shakespeare and is great with actors. But that was a lovely play. I enjoyed it very much.
I think I'd have to rate it in my top 10 productions, you know, ever. That
really?
Oh, yeah, I loved it. But this is, would you look at the time, and there are so many things we haven't talked about and so many people we haven't mentioned, and I hope they'll forgive us. But I think it's fair to say that we could do another 10 of these programmes and we'd still only be scratching the surface. My thanks to Peg Monaghan, Colette Proctor, Aidan Grinnell and Micheál O'Hay for sharing their memories
with us.
Thank you, Jerry. Thanks very much. Thanks, Micheál. Thanks to you at home for listening. And a very sincere thank you to all those temporary, unestablished civil servants, the ladies and gentlemen, past and present, of the RTE Players, the Radio Air and Repertory Company, the REP, for all the enjoyment which they've brought to us during the last 50 years, and long may the great tradition of radio drama in RTE continue. We leave you now with a landmark in broadcasting history, endorsed by no less an authority than the Guinness Book of Records. These are the closing moments from the 31-hour dramatization and continuous broadcast on June the 16th and 17th, 1982, of James Joyce's Ulysses. Once again, the brainchild of Micheál O'Hay, and I think all of us were in it at one stage or another. Peg Monaghan plays Molly Bloom. Good night. God bless you.
As for them saying there's no God, I wouldn't give a snap of my two fingers for all their learning. Why don't they go and create something? I often asked him. Atheists, or whatever they call themselves, go and wash the cobbles off themselves first. Then they go howling for the priest and they dying. And why? Why? Because they're afraid of hell on account of their bad conscience. Ah, yes, I know them well. Who was the first person in the universe before there was anybody that made it all? Who? Ah? That they don't know. Neither do I, so there you are. They might as well try to stop the sun from rising tomorrow. The sun shines for you, he said, the day we were lying among the rhododendrons on Hoth Head, in the grey tweed suit and his straw hat, the day I got him to propose to me. Yes, first I gave him the bit of seed cake out of my mouth, and it was leap year like now. Yes. 16 years ago. My God, after that long kiss I near lost my breath. Yes, he said, I was a flower of the mountain. Yes, so we are, flowers, all a woman's body. Yes, that was the one true thing he said in his life, and the sun shines for you today. Yes, that was why I liked him, because I saw he understood or felt what a woman is, and I knew I could always get round him, and I gave him all the pleasure I could, leading him on till he asked me to say yes. And I wouldn't answer first, only looked out over the sea and the sky. I was thinking of so many things he didn't know of. Malvi and Mr. Stanhope and Hester and Father and old Captain Groves and the sailors playing All Birds Fly and I Say Stoop, and washing up dishes, they called it, at the pier, and the sentry in front of the governor's house with the thing round his white helmet, poor devil, half roasted, and the Spanish girls laughing in their shawls and their tall combs, and the auctions in the morning, the Greeks and the Jews and the Arabs and the devil knows who else from all the ends of Europe, and Duke Street and the Fowl Market all clucking outside Larby Sharon's, and the poor donkeys slipping half asleep, and the vague fellows in the cloaks asleep in the shade on the steps, and the big wheels of the carts of the bulls, and the old castle thousands of years old. Yes, and those handsome Moors all in white, and turbans like kings, asking you to sit down in the little bit of a shop, and Rhonda with the old windows of the Posadas, glancing eyes a lattice hid for her lover to kiss, the iron and the wine shops half open at night, and the castanets, and the night we missed the boat at Algeciras, the watchman going about serene with his lamp, and oh, that awful deep-down torrent, oh, and the sea crimson, sometimes like fire, and the glorious sunsets, and the fig trees in the Alameda Gardens, yes, and all the queer little streets and pink and blue and yellow houses and the rose gardens and the jessamine and the geraniums and cactuses and Gibraltar as a girl while I was a flower of the mountain. Yes, when I put the rose in my hair like the Andalusian girls used, or shall I wear a red? Yes, and how he kissed me under the Moorish wall, and I thought, well, as well him as another. And then I asked him with my eyes to ask again. Yes, and then he asked me, would I? Yes, to say yes, my mountain flower. And first I put my arms round him, yes, and drew him down to me so he could feel my breasts all perfume, yes, and his heart was going like mad. Yes, I said, yes, I will, yes.
Yes, indeed. Peg Monaghan there as Molly Bloom with the closing lines from the 1982 RTE dramatised broadcast of James Joyce's Ulysses. Temporary Unestablished Civil Servants was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 19th of August, 1997.